It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about a new study that found that the economic and ecological impact of invasive species here in Wisconsin lakes has been greatly underestimated. First, Wisconsin is gearing up for statewide elections next week in addition to the presidential primary. Governor Scott Walker isn't on the ballot, but you might not realize it watching campaign ads for the Milwaukee County Executive, Milwaukee Mayor, and the State Supreme Court. Mary Spacuzza is with us to talk about the role Governor Walker is playing in these elections, whether he wants to or not. She's a reporter who covers politics and breaking news at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So yeah, Governor Scott Walker, not up for election for a couple years yet, but he's showing up a lot, you write, in campaign ads. How are we seeing him? What role is he playing there?
You know, we're seeing a lot of candidates who are either Democrat or liberal-leaning accusing their opponent of being Scott Walker or being affiliated with him or having his ideas. So in the county executive's race, actually both Chris Abley and Chris Larson are accusing their opponent of being like Scott Walker. It's kind of an odd fight of like, no, you're Scott Walker, no, you're Scott Walker. Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, is accusing his opponent, his challenger Bob Donovan, a longtime alderman, of having Scott Walker's ideas or sharing Scott Walker's ideas. And then obviously Judge Kloppenburg, who's going up against Rebecca Bradley, is trying to link her opponent to Scott Walker. That link is because Bradley has been appointed by Governor Walker 3 times in 3 years, so she's been hammering that in her ads.
And I guess the idea is Governor Walker's approval rating is lower than it had been, especially after his presidential run, and I guess there's a hope that candidates can capitalize on that by attaching him to their opponents?
Yeah, it's kind of like trying to tie their opponent to somebody's sinking approval ratings. And Governor Walker, in recent Marquette polls, for example, has been hovering at about 40% in the most recent polls that we've seen, slightly lower in some places. And so I think that candidates are just hoping that if people think of their opponent as someone who is closely affiliated with a governor who's pretty unpopular right now, that people will check the other box when they go to the polls.
You talk to some people in the political strategy world, and this is, you know, a couple degrees of separation in some ways. Is there a thought that, hey, this might actually work?
I think so, yeah. I think that Democratic strategists will tell you that, yes, they do think this is going to work, that he is so unpopular right now that people are going to kind of want to almost vote against him by voting for the person who is less like him. Of course, when we asked Governor Walker about this last week, he said, well, polls go up and down, and I was, you know, very unpopular in the wake of the Act 10 battle and protests, and he mentioned Time magazine having a headline calling him Dead Man Walker because he was so low in the polls that a lot of people didn't think he would survive the recall fight, which he obviously did.
Talking to Mary Spacuzza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about next week's elections here in Wisconsin and one name not on the ballot, Governor Scott Walker, and the role he's playing. Let's dig a little closer into each of these races, Mary, starting with, you mentioned the Milwaukee County Executive race. Now, this is Scott Walker's old gig, of course. And
right.
We've got the incumbent Chris Abley, challenger State Senator Chris Larson. So what kind of particular accusations are they leveling at each other, both Democrats trying to associate the other one with the Republican governor?
Right. So there are some ads. Actually, this is a third-party group, but this is pretty classic of what we've seen in the race. There's a mailer that said, when you look closer at Chris Abley, you start to see someone else, and it's like a magnifying glass with Abley and Walker right next to each other, basically saying, like, Abley is kind of a Governor Walker in sheep's clothing. Then Chris Abley has been saying that Senator Larson, who's a Democratic senator, state senator from Milwaukee, has sided with Governor Walker when it came to Wall Street, referring to a bill that was passed at the state capitol in Madison. He has basically been trying to paint himself almost to the left of Chris Larson, who's seen as a quite liberal senator, but basically trying to say that, no, it's not me who is like Scott Walker, it's actually my opponent.
You know, outside of election season, you might look at either of those things and say, ah, someone who can reach across party lines, work with the other side, bipartisan approach, all of a sudden come election time, that can be a big negative depending on where you are.
Yeah, nobody is really, I've not seen any candidates really highlighting in their advertising their close ties to Governor Walker or how collaboratively, how much they've worked with him in collaboration on past issues.
Now, on the Milwaukee mayoral race, you've got incumbent Tom Barrett. It's a nonpartisan race, but he's held office as a Democrat, run as a Democrat for governor in the past. And then his challenger, you mentioned Alderman Bob Donovan, seen definitely as a conservative. So this is something that's maybe a little easier to hang a conservative, not conservative label on, it sounds like.
Well, it is. It's technically a nonpartisan race, and Bob Donovan has said, well, I ran as a Republican a couple of times years ago, but I'm an independent, and I'll work with anybody, but I am not tied to Scott Walker. However, he hasn't taken as firm of a stance against things like gun control, which Mayor Barrett has clearly been advocating for. That's kind of seen as a conservative liberal fight that's going on. So yes, he's probably taken positions that are seen as more conservative than Mayor Barrett. At the same time, he does not define himself as a Republican or a conservative and insists he's independent.
And yet, as you mentioned, Mayor Barrett is trying to associate him with Governor Walker.
Yes, he's saying that he is someone with Scott Walker's ideas and Donald Trump's erratic temperament. So he's trying to tie them to both of those folks. And, while Donald Trump may be the front runner, he does have some pretty high ratings in Wisconsin for people who just don't really like him.
And then moving to another hypothetically nonpartisan race, the state Supreme Court race. You mentioned, again, nonpartisan, but pretty partisan battle lines drawn when you look at who supports who. So who is bringing up Governor Walker in that race?
That would be Joanne Kloppenburg, the challenger, who's a appeals court judge. She has been repeatedly bringing up Governor Walker's name, saying that Governor Walker appointed Rebecca Bradley to three positions in 3 years, that essentially Justice Bradley is a partisan who will just further the partisanship on the Supreme Court. Kloppenburg has been presenting herself as a independent and someone who would just rule based on the law and not based on politics. Of course, that is not something that the Bradley campaign or her supporters would agree with, and they say that she's the one who's partisan. So, however, Bradley, you've not seen Governor Walker showing up that we've seen and that we know of in any kind of campaign literature, ads, TV, radio, nothing like that.
And you mentioned talking to Governor Walker last week. What did he say about his role or non-role in this Supreme Court race?
So he actually said that he thinks that the only difference between Justice Bradley and Judge Kloppenburg is essentially qualifications, that Kloppenburg had tried to get appointments in the past and was unsuccessful, and the only difference is that Bradley was successful because of her work. So I'm sure Kloppenburg supporters would disagree with that, but that is what he told us at a stop in Milwaukee last week.
And of course, Mary, the race that's getting a lot of attention is the presidential primary last week. The governor, to my knowledge, at least as of airtime, hasn't endorsed anyone in that race either. Any idea whether he is expected to in the next 8 days?
He gave some signals that he is seriously thinking about an endorsement. When we asked him about that last week, he said that if he chooses to endorse, it would be after the Easter holiday, and that it would be one of two of the three candidates that he's more closely aligned with. When my colleague Dan Bice pressed him on that, he confirmed that he was referring to Governor Kasich or Ted Cruz, not to Donald Trump. And of course, Governor Walker, when he got out of the presidential race back in September, essentially called for others to do the same, saying that he wanted a positive conservative to rise to take on the current front runner, who was Trump. So he is not a Trump supporter and has not been for some time. So I don't think anybody would be surprised. There's a Marquette poll coming out on Wednesday. I don't think that we would be surprised if he endorses sometime midweek, and I don't think anyone would be surprised if he were to endorse, for example, Ted Cruz, who a lot of conservatives are kind of rallying around in the state right now.
We'll leave it there for now. Mary, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Mary Spacuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about the role Governor Scott Walker is playing in next week's statewide elections. A recent study conducted by the UW-Madison found that the economic and ecological impact of invasive species here in Wisconsin, especially on our lakes, may have been greatly underestimated in the past. Joining us now is Jake Walsh. He's a PhD candidate at the UW Center for Limnology, lead author of this report. Jake, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So talk about the invasive species that you were looking at in this study. And this is mainly in what you've said is one of the longest studied lakes in the country, Lake Mendota in Madison.
Yeah, absolutely. So the CFL has been on the lake for over 100 years now. And we focused on spiny water flea, which is an invasive zooplankton. Zooplankton are tiny aquatic organisms in lakes. And the spiny water flea is a predator, so it eats other zooplankton. In particular, it eats Daphnia. And Daphnia are really important to us here in Madison because Daphnia eat huge amounts of algae. And they can actually keep the lake clear by eating algae. So when spiny water flea comes in, they ate all of our Daphnia, and our water's a lot murkier as a result.
Right. And this bigger picture, this is just one of scores, really, of invasive species that people are keeping an eye on in Wisconsin. How big did we think our invasive species problem was?
So before spiny water flea, we had a pretty good idea that it was very large. Estimates have been anywhere from billions to hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And when we look at how spiny water flea is impacting ecosystem services like water clarity, that number becomes much larger.
Right. So how are you trying to put this price tag on here and try to estimate a price tag for the economic impact, but also the wider ecological impact of this particular invasive?
Yeah, absolutely. So we quantified how much water clarity we lost with the invasion, how much murkier Lake Mendota got. And then we were interested in what that clarity was worth to Madison citizens. And luckily, somebody did that study 15 years ago or so, where they asked Madison, or Dane County rather, how much would you be willing to pay for good water clarity in Lake Mendota? And so we updated those numbers, and we got a value of over $100 million for the clarity that we lost with the invasion. And then the second part of the study is thinking about how can we get that clarity back, and how can we invest in a cleaner lake so that we can offset the impacts of spiny water flea. And since there aren't any ways to directly manage spiny water flea, we thought we could go around the problem and think of reducing the phosphorus load into the lake. And phosphorus is key for fertilizing algae growth. So if we reduce the phosphorus load, we could offset spiny water flea's impact.
Right, because this is a case where it's a double-barreled problem, it sounds like. We've got this invasive species that came here via the Great Lakes, so we can get more into that roadway of invasives in a bit. And that kills kind of the good guys that eat the algae we don't want. At the same time, we've got this phosphorus problem that's fueling the growth of this algae. So that's a case where the invasive species is interacting with pollution, I guess, right?
Absolutely. So Daphnia, that tiny good guy that I mentioned, that's been the best thing we've had going for us in the fight against pollution in Lake Mendota. And spiny water flea effectively ripped off that Band-Aid. So now the only way we can control water clarity in the lake anymore is by reducing the phosphorus load. And we found a project of that magnitude would cost anywhere from $80 to $160 million. So we're talking about really challenging things brought on by an invasive species.
A lot of invasive species, we talk about, you know, stopping their spread, like purple loosestrife, or eradicating them, putting up barriers to keep Asian carp out. Is there any way to turn back the tide against this particular organism you were studying here?
So there isn't. And I think one of the big reasons is there hasn't been a reason to for spiny water flea till this moment. So when we value invasive species impact on ecosystem services, we have a better reason to invest in research on how to control, eradicate, or prevent invasions by spiny water flea.
Talking to Jake Walsh from the UW Center for Limnology about invasive species and the economic impacts, the ecological impacts they can have on us here in the state, focusing on the lakes here. A new study finds the impact on water quality is maybe worse than we had expected in the past. And let's look bigger picture. When we're talking water and invasive species, a lot of the focus, and I think you say this in your report, has been on the Great Lakes themselves. You're trying to look more inland to our waterways within the state.
Absolutely. So the tens of thousands of lakes inland of the Great Lakes make up like 30 to 40 times the shoreline of the Great Lakes themselves. And so they're equally, or they're a big part of the economy in the states bordering the Great Lakes. And we wanted to look specifically at how invasive species are impacting those lakes because it has been underrepresented in the conversation.
Why haven't we studied that as much?
I think, you know, there's a lot of lakes, and it's hard to really wrap your head around all of them. I mean, we have Lake Mendota here in Madison, which is, you know, adjacent to our research center. So we have a really nice picture of what's happening in Mendota. But in many of the other lakes, I think it's really challenging to come up with that comprehensive picture and then also estimate impact on ecosystem services like water quality, which we often describe as invaluable.
Are we seeing similar problems, do you know, in other lakes around the state? Will other people, or is this something that's maybe on the horizon for other lakes?
We think it might be on the horizon. This is kind of a unique new impact for spiny water flea, but this is also the first time that spiny water flea has invaded a lake where we have this sort of phosphorus loading agricultural problem. And we think that's really key to its impact in the state.
And for people not familiar with Lake Mendota, as someone who's lived near it, I mean, you've got about a 2-week window where the water is clear until summer hits, and then it looks really gross. It's something that keeps people from swimming in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we did. We used to have this great, we call it the clear water phase in the spring. It should be coming up in the next couple months here, but that period is much shorter now with spiny water flea. And you're right, once that period's over, blue-green blooms basically describe what summer's like in Lake Mendota, and we've seen that a little bit worse as well since spiny water flea showed up.
And with this study focusing on Lake Mendota, is this part of an effort to maybe change the way we think about the invasive species problem here in the state and around the country?
Absolutely. It's a big call for incorporating ecosystem services into the conversation, because they're literally how we value ecosystems. And to this point, we haven't thought much about invasive species impact on ecosystem services. So it's a call to bring that into the conversation and to have better information when we make decisions about invasive species.
Let's talk more about this concept of the ecosystem services. This is one case where it's a really clear link. This is taking out something that we need to keep the algae down. Is it often more subtle than that?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, so I think one thing is you can think about fishing on lakes. I think that's one thing that's actually been described fairly well, is how invasive species impact fishing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're talking about really subtle things, and water clarity speaks to the aesthetic value of a lake. When you look at the lake, do you like it more or less? And then that impacts, of course, everything else you do on the lake, from boating, fishing, and swimming. And so they are subtle, and that's part of why it's hard to put a dollar number on those values.
And let's talk about, I call it a highway earlier, via the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Great Lakes, and shipping. How big a factor is that in introducing invasive species into inland waterways here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. So there's been over 180 species that have arrived through that pathway. And of course, not all of those are harmful. Mm-hmm. A small percentage of them are. But that's been the primary pathway to get invasive species into inland lakes like Lake Mendota.
And so do they become endemic first in, say, Lake Michigan, and then find their way up the rivers and waterways?
Yeah, that's part of it. I think the biggest way that they get from the Great Lakes to lakes like Lake Mendota is through recreational boating. So we actually have a lot of control over that pathway, assuming that we're cleaning, draining, and drying our boats.
Right, and we've seen signs around the state. I think it's mostly targeting mussels, if I'm not mistaken, to try to get people to clean their boats before going from one lake to another.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that kind of thing actually make a difference?
We'd like to think it does. I don't actually have a lot of information on how much of a difference it makes, but it does certainly increase awareness of invasive species in the state. And I think it's an ongoing process of trying to get people aware and get people behaving in such a way to protect ecosystem services and lakes.
Yeah, and so with your research into Lake Mendota, how do you think that should inform the way we try to stop the next species from spreading into a lake and having a bad or at best uncertain effect on those ecosystem services?
Absolutely. So because these results are so striking and the damages are so expensive, we think that it warrants more research into better control and prevention methods, and maybe more extreme prevention methods, thinking about larger scale projects that are going to be more effective at stopping invasive species from spreading.
So this study is, as you mentioned, basically in your backyard in Lake Mendota. Are you hoping to try to take this on the road or on the river, I guess, and look at other waterways and see how this and other species are doing these things?
I don't know if me personally, but I think that is exactly what we're calling for here, is let's keep figuring out what invasive species are doing to ecosystem services and expanding our knowledge of this issue. Absolutely.
Is there a growing interest in this in the limnology field, which really came from your department, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So ecosystem services have exploded recently, and largely the invasive species impact on ecosystem services has been, it hasn't exploded in the same way. Mm-hmm. But ecosystem services are a really important part of how we're starting to do ecology and how we're thinking about the cross-section of ecology and economics, or and us, essentially.
So do you have a hope that a lake like Lake Mendota could stay clear more of the spring and summer in the future?
I think we would have to go into more research how to directly control spiny water flea. I think our biggest hope is in reducing the phosphorus loading into the lake. And I think there is some hope there as long as we stick to it.
Jake, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Jake Walsh. He's the author of the Invasive Species Study we've been talking about. He's a PhD candidate at the UW Center for Limnology. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. In Milwaukee and in cities around the country, there's often a cultural mismatch between students and their teachers. A report last year from the Public Policy Forum found that 10% of Milwaukee teachers were from minority groups, while 44% of students are people of color. And research from the American Federation of Teachers found that in urban areas around the country, there was a decline in the number of minority teachers. So many of the people teaching in schools in lower-income urban areas, with many people of color, are white. Often they're from middle-class backgrounds. And our next guest says even for teachers with the best of intentions, these cultural differences can be a major obstacle unless we rethink the way we teach. Christopher Emden joins us now. He's an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Teachers College at Columbia University. He was the 2015 Multicultural Educator of the Year, awarded by the National Association of Multicultural Educators. His new book is called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, before we get into the advice in your book, some people might think, hey, teachers are teachers, students are students, standards are standards, no matter what people's background. So why should we be paying more attention to, you know, the cultural backgrounds of students and their teachers?
Because everything that you just said is actually so far from sort of legitimate when we look at the reality of schools. So if we say teachers are just teachers and students are just students, then we have to ask questions about why is it that particular populations consistently are not doing as well as their counterparts. If we can believe that all students have the same sort of academic abilities and same skill sets and same strengths, and they're able to prove those skill sets and strengths when they're outside of school, then the issue has to be something about the context of schools. Now, I'm not saying the issue is necessarily just resting at the fact that there are sort of these cultural differences between students and teachers alone. However, it is an elephant in the room that we don't address and we have not addressed, and I believe that starting there is a way forward.
And it seems like a lot of times there's more and more of a cookie-cutter approach where all teachers should teach the same material in the same way, or some other people might say, here's the way to be successful as a teacher in an urban neighborhood. As I look through your book, it seems like you're saying the key is to see the students as individuals and fit their individual strengths, weaknesses, interests into the way the classroom works.
Absolutely. Well, if there's one thing that we know about education, for anybody who is sort of in classrooms, working in classrooms, or conducting research in real classrooms, we know that the way that education is sort of played out from a larger, more policy standards perspective is this idea of making everything uniform. But this uniform nature of how we are expected to teach runs counter to everything that we know about teaching. So the best teaching is deeply personalized. It does focus on the ways of knowing and being and understanding and culture of the young people. And so if you're imposing an approach to teaching and learning that is very uniform, that's extracted from your culture, then it serves as an additional barrier to you being able to sort of be fully actualized in the classroom. It serves as a barrier for a teacher to be effective. And so what I'm laying out here is an approach to teaching and learning that gives teachers an opportunity to be able to have a tool for sort of interrogating youth culture and then a mechanism for using what comes out of their study of the culture to be more effective in their teaching.
And one problem you're trying to solve is that a teacher or somebody observing from the outside comes in with assumptions about the kids in a classroom. If we're thinking about African-American youth in a high school, say, we have assumptions about that, and we can misinterpret behavior as being disconnected or acting out. And you talk about video examples of this. How does that happen? How does that play out in the classroom?
So what I do in the book is I really lay out a bunch of stories and a bunch of anecdotes of things that I've witnessed firsthand being in classrooms, where a teacher will perceive a student as enacting a behavior that she thinks is suspension worthy, and then we have a conversation with the student, and you realize the student actually really wants to be in that classroom and really wants to be the learn, what really wants to learn. And there's this huge gap between what the teacher thinks and what the student is experiencing. There have been all other scenarios where, you know, the student is enacting a behavior that actually is a marker of sort of interest and sort of jumping out of their seat because they can't wait to learn more, and a teacher perceives that as being disruptive. And so, you know, we come into urban spaces oftentimes based on our own norms, to be completely frank and honest, white middle class norms for folks who are socioeconomically advantaged are just very different than what the norms are for young people of color in urban communities. Just the nature of exchange is different. And so part of what I sort of lay out here is, how does the teacher learn how to identify these phenomena that may be misperceived as the interest in education, when in reality they may be a trigger for having kids actually really fully engaged? And I do so again through story, but I also do so by couching that description in research and firsthand experience.
Well, I want to get to a firsthand experience you had, not as a teacher or a researcher, but when you were in 10th grade, you had a really dramatic example of getting in trouble based on an assumption about your behavior. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the most striking stories that I try to share in the book. You know, I remember, you know, growing up in an urban community that was, you know, challenging in many respects. And I ended up, you know, going into my apartment building as a young man, and there was a shootout, and I froze. I stood just, you know, froze because the whole entire experience scared me. When I got home, I spoke to my mom, and my sister was describing what happened, and my mom said, "Chris, when if something like that ever happens again, you can't afford to just freeze. I mean, you have to duck, you have to hit the floor. If you're on the floor, it's less likely for you to actually get shot." And I took her advice to heart. And I get into school, I'm in the classroom, the teacher is teaching, and as we're teaching, a loud noise comes from the hallway, probably a door slamming or something to that effect. And for me, immediately it triggered this gunshot moment, and I jumped underneath the table. and in jumping underneath the table, you know, the teacher walked up to my desk and misperceived my reaction to the sound as me being purposely being a class clown or being disruptive, when in reality it was really, you know, a traumatic experience that I was reliving. And in response to that sort of like that misunderstanding of that experience, all I could do was just play like I didn't care. You know, I laughed, you know, the class laughed it off, I smiled it off, I walked out of the classroom, out of the hallway, that triggers a kind of relationship with that teacher, who did not understand the fact that my response in that moment was not me being a class clown, was not me not wanting to learn, but rather a response to an experience that I just had a visceral, almost emotional, psychological response to. And for me, those kind of moments are trauma. And in the book, I talk about this idea of how young people experience trauma every day that teachers cannot recognize. And when somebody's experiencing trauma and you don't recognize it, then they suffer in that classroom. They can't learn in that classroom. And so in the book, I sort of play out these type of scenarios and help guide teachers through this process, but also help guide other folks who are interested in education, whether you're just an outside party or a stakeholder on a school board or a parent. You know, how do you help the teacher to be able to make sense of the experiences of young people of color?
Talking to Christopher Emden, his new book is called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. He's helping bridge a lot of cultural gaps, a lot of misunderstanding in classrooms. And I want to get into the classroom now, Chris. You give a lot of strategies, ways to bring students on board in some ways. And I want to start with a concept that you call, I think it's co-generation, where you the teacher works with the students in a way to create the curriculum or what happens on a day-to-day basis. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. And if I may, you know, a lot of people who work in urban education or describe what's happening in urban education do a really good job at describing what's wrong and describing the issues with the teachers and describing the statistics. And I made it a point in this book to give solutions. And each chapter is filled with solutions. And so this dialogue that you're describing, what I call the co-generative dialogue, you know, essentially is having the teacher create a moment or a set of spaces where they can engage with three or four students about the classroom and how those kids are experiencing experiencing the classroom, and then co-constructing a method for teaching appropriately based on those students' feedback. It really is a simple process, but that goes a long way. So in my research, I've had young people tell teachers about things that the teacher would not have recognized. The fact that you only stand next to the smart kids, and the teacher says, well, I think you're all smart, but the students are experiencing the fact that you're only privileging certain students in the classroom. And so now they can help you to be able to rethink the process of what you do in the classroom. And part of the entire process that I outlined is how do you empower young people to be a part of the teaching and learning process, not just as passive learners, but active engagers in the process, almost partners with the teacher to make the class run more efficiently.
And you have to be pretty humble as a teacher to do that, I think, and be willing to relinquish some authority. And you experienced this yourself as a teacher. You did this co-generation where your students said, it makes us uncomfortable when you raise your voice, and you do it a lot.
Yeah, you know, I think this is also important to note. You know, the title of the book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, but it's also for the rest of y'all, too. So I speak from a vantage point also as a man of color in schools with young folks of color, and them telling me what they need from me to be more effective and my unwillingness to shift because I think that they are just, you know, they're just being mean or they're just being critical for no reason. And then I can only imagine a person who does not look like these kids, who's not from the same community, who does not speak the same language, who comes from a different socioeconomic background. If I, who has a deep connected and embeddedness in that community, can have that kind of experience, you could only imagine that for somebody who doesn't. And so, not only does it require humility, but it also requires an understanding that you are always learning as a teacher, and that the students are the ones who are going to teach you. And it requires you being willing to be an active learner about the students' lives before you can be effective. And not only in a sort of philosophical way, but in a way where there are strategies to help you do that.
Talking to Christopher Emden. His new book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all, too. He says we need to pay attention to cultural differences between teachers and students, make the classroom a friendlier place for students from all backgrounds. He's sharing some ideas, some strategies even, on how to do that. We'll get into some more of his advice in just a few minutes. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your stories and your questions. If you have experience with these cultural differences in the classroom as a parent, a student, a teacher, an administrator, share your perspective. How can we bridge these gaps? How did you try to bridge them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Christopher Emden. His new book is called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. He's sharing advice to help reach across cultural boundaries in schools, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this in person as a student, a teacher, or a parent? What worked, what didn't work when the teacher was from a different background, different culture than the students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Chris, another idea you talk about in the book is co-teaching, bringing the students on board, I guess, to help teach a subject. How would that play out?
You know, one of the most sort of fascinating things that I find is when young people who have been identified as troublemakers or identified as disinterested in school are given the opportunity to lead the conversation. When they're given the chance to actually go home, design a lesson, bring it back to class, study the content, and then deliver that information. And once young people are given the opportunity to do that, there are things about how they engage with each other that actually gives the teachers strategies to be more effective. And so co-teaching, you know, as I laid out in the book, is an approach to teaching and learning, not where you have, you know, two adults and one gets the copies or whatever else it is, but rather one where young people are empowered to be able to take ownership over the teaching and learning and the distribution of information. And the only time that a teacher gets in the way of the kids actually teaching is if the content is off. And in this way, the teacher simply becomes a sideline participant in the teaching and learning process while the learning is active for young folks and young folks of color in particular. And what's fascinating about co-teaching is that in the best schools, for most socioeconomically advantaged communities, the best and top private schools in the nation, this is a part of what they do every day. Young people are empowered. They're allowed to teach. They're allowed to lead the instruction. What we find in schools that are more socioeconomically disadvantaged or where they have a majority youth of color, the approaches to teaching and learning are a lot more regimented and a lot more strict and a lot more structured. And what I make the argument for is that if you loosen the structure to reflect what we know is best practice for everyone, you would be surprised at how the young people who've been described as disinterested actually become engaged and become empowered.
That reminds me, you say in the book that you think there's too much attention paid to having the perfect lesson plan in place, to maintaining the right level of discipline in the class, and not to creating this positive, I guess, interactive environment with the students.
Listen, we all know that for a teacher to be effective, or for anybody who's presenting to a larger or wide audience to be effective, they have to have planned their work. They should have structured what it is that they want to do. However, following a script runs counter to everything that we know about teaching and learning for the most marginalized populations and also for all populations. If a teacher goes in there and has all 40 minutes of their lesson designed to a T and knows what's going to happen by the 2-minute and 34-second mark and knows what's going to happen by the 38-minute and 24-second mark, that teacher is not going to be as effective as a teacher who understands how to receive the information from the student, take the energy from what the students are giving them, and then maneuver the teaching to be able to meet their goals. You want to keep your academic goals intact. You want to know, I want to make sure at the end of this lesson the kids understand genetics or they understand how to balance equations. But the path towards balancing equations or doing genetics is oftentimes not found in the script. It's found in your ability as an educator to be able to leave the script behind in the interest of ensuring that your students are with you. So I've taught in schools or follow teachers around who are so committed to their lesson plan, so committed to their textbook, so committed to what the district hands them that they are ineffective because young people are bored to death half the time because you're spending the whole darn class following a script instead of actually teaching.
I remember in school a couple times the teachers let us play Jeopardy, but themed, you know, along whatever, the social studies, science, whatever it was. And I thought, all right, we're slacking off, having some fun here. But you write that the teacher's actually tricking us. We actually were learning pretty effectively by playing Jeopardy.
You know, I've been in schools all across the country, and teachers will play Jeopardy when they're trying to prepare their students for a test. And you see the joy in the classroom. The kids are engaged. They're raising their hands. They're having fun. They're competing with their peers. And they're learning content. And this probably happens maybe, you know, 3 days before the test when a teacher's just trying to make sure that they know what's going on. Why do we wait for 3 days before the test to do the stuff that the kids are enjoying? Why can't you create a structure like Jeopardy or Jeopardy more consistently or academic games more consistently? And I know what folks are thinking. Oh, so Emden is saying don't be academically rigorous. It is a fallacy. It's a lie that to have fun and play an academic game lacks academic or intellectual rigor. I can maintain my academic rigor while kids are having fun at the exact same time. And the way that the system is structured thus far, particularly for young people of color, is to extract out anything that might be in any semblance that they have some kind of expression of joy in the classroom. Well, the best psychological research, the best academic research lets us know that if young people have positive emotions around the learning experience, they're more likely to retain the information. And if we do the opposite, where they don't have positive experiences around the learning experience, they're less likely to learn the information. So I'm not reinventing the wheel here. I'm just bringing back up what we fundamentally know is true and right to do, and then presenting it in a way where it meets the needs for a very particular population.
Talking about teaching with Christopher Emden. His book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. Following up on the Jeopardy idea, Chris, I know you're a big fan of, and you've got a chapter on it, competition as a way to get kids excited about what they're learning. What kind of things, apart from that game of Jeopardy, will work?
Oh, man, competition just around the ways that you present information in class. You know, not just on a written exam, but who can create the best poem about a science concept? Who can create the best interpretive dance about the process of balancing equations? You know, how can we have class A in the morning compete with class B on who can have the higher average on an examination or a presentation where they all know about it and they all try to one-up each other? But it's not competition in the sense of, you know, it's a high-stakes competition, and if you lose, it's doom and gloom. It's competition in the sense that let us enjoy the process together and make the entire process almost gamified, right? And so when I talk about competition, I talk about the art of friendly competition. I talk about the art of being competing with somebody with a larger goal of each of you being better. And in the book, I give an example of capoeira, for example, that looks like two folks are actually fighting, but in reality, they're sharpening their skill set that can be used to fight. And I think that if educators are more deliberate about how we use the magic of competition to be an anchor for how we get youth to be able to engage and be invested in what's going on in the classroom, we'd be better served.
Big picture, Chris, you've got a lot of ideas. They sound like fun, but who makes it happen? Does it take a cadre of superhero teachers? Who's going to put this into place?
I firmly believe that it requires everyone. I do believe that the classroom is ground zero for changing teaching and learning in this country, particularly for populations who have been, you know, traditionally sort of underserved. I think that if we have a cadre of teachers who just believe in the art and craft of teaching again, that we would be better served. But I also think it requires parents who have expectations of teaching to be engaging to their young people. It also requires school board members to say, listen, I know that for us to be able to do this right, we have to have conversations with teachers about what it is that we feel should be our best for students. So, you know, what I'm arguing for here is using the classroom as the fundamental place from which transformative education happens, with investment from everybody who's a stakeholder in education.
Very briefly, Chris, as we wrap up, when you talk to teachers and administrators, are they excited about what you're talking about?
You know, I get some folks who are so excited they're jumping out of their skin, and then I have some folks who are so offended. You know, the title of my book is, you know, for white folks who teach in the hood and the rest of y'all too. Somebody is listening to your station right now and was going to call in and heard that the title of the book was for white folks, and the minute I say white folks, they perceive me to be a racist, or they perceive me to, you know, to be purposely talking about race issues because I want to create some angst within communities. No, I'm talking about for white folks who teach in the hood, because the majority of folks who teach in the hood are white folks. And I need white folks to be able to understand how to teach young people of color better. So it's not that I'm trying to push white folks out of the community or make them feel bad about being ineffective. It's saying you are here in this community. You're probably there because you care about this community. Now, how can we work together to ensure that we're doing what's right by young people? So the responses have been varied. Whether folks love this work, they're implementing some of the strategies already and saying, oh my gosh, this is working. I can't believe that you're suggesting something and it's actually working with these kids who've never been engaging with me. Or folks who say,
well, we've got to leave it there. Thanks to Christopher Emden. His new book is For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all, too. If you were keeping score at home, you'll know I was off last week. Well, I was on a spring break trip with my family to New Orleans and Memphis. And in addition to seeing the sights and being a tourist, I tried lots of the regional foods in both cities. It was, you know, research for Food Friday, right? Well, in New Orleans, I had a po' boy, a muffaletta, a couple of gumbos, Zapp's potato chips, an old favorite of mine, and some beignets. Still not sure what the plural is. In Memphis, some classic barbecue ribs plus the slaw, and great Mexican food in New Orleans, who knew, and amazing falafel in Memphis. So this all leads me to my question for you. What is your favorite regional food that you wish we could get more of here in Wisconsin? Is there a restaurant somewhere else in the country that you wish you could just load up and bring to your hometown? And is there a food that you can get here but we just don't make it like they do in that other place? You know, the New Yorker who talks about the bagels that you just can't get anywhere else but in New York. I want you to tell us about it. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page where I've included some important information about gumbo. We'll go out with a little taste of New Orleans via Wisconsin with Mama Dig Down's Brass Band. This is Central Time.